So this is the third talk of a series. It's a continuation, and we have new people. So our challenges are before us. However, our experiences are pretty much the same in the areas in which we're going to speak, so no one's going to be unfamiliar with this. Although my notes, which I had to reconstruct because I left them at home, that's why people didn't see me earlier. I was busy scribbling. It's important to center the mind somehow. But I want to start a little bit with meditation, discussing meditation. I listened to last week, which is a very good discussion. I like especially the part about remaining like a dog. And I have this whole satire in my head on Shantideva, but I'll share that some other time. But, you know, when we talk about working with afflictive emotions, I mean, the stuff that just drives us crazy, Buddhists are very good at this, but so is the Western tradition. We have whole traditions of not only there's spiritual traditions of the West, but also Stoic philosophy. And we know how we do it when we have a, quote, philosophical response to something. It means that we're kind of backing off emotionally. And there's something in the Western tradition about that. However, we Buddhists have an advantage, a few advantages. The Stoics mostly use philosophizing exhortation. We'll talk about Buddhist exhortation in a minute. But we also have meditation practice. And meditation practice, first of all, gives us a lot of experience working with not being comfortable. Right? If anyone tells me they have a blissful time doing meditation, I'll know that, you know, they are deceiving me. But what does meditation do? Partly because it allows us to dwell in not being comfortable, we are able to notice our mind and our responses as they come and go. We're not in the thick of anything other than our mind, which is quite lovely, because in our daily lives we're usually in the thick of things. And we have our immediate responses, and we have our immediate habits. But meditation, you can't really do habits that way. You go into these realms of fantasy or aggressive fantasy or dreams of revenge or things like that. And at some point, you know that that's what you're doing. It sort of flops. So meditation is very good practice for daily life and dealing with what we deal with. Now, the topic today is how not to cause harm. And it's based on some Buddhist precepts. And not causing harm means not causing harm to others, because we know that it rebounds back on us sooner or later. But it's also not causing harm to ourselves. And all of us have our individual ways of causing harm to ourselves. We also have our individual ways, we all do it, of increasing our misery in life. And, you know, there's a difference between suffering and misery. And to some extent, and I'm not trying to bum you up, I'm going to cheer everybody up later. But, you know, much of what... I love that T-shirt. I want it. You want trade shirts? It'd be a great running shirt. But what we usually do is add to things. Our lives experience. We experience oscillations of pleasure and pain, comfort, discomfort. We narrow our lives by wanting one and trying to exclude the other. We freak out when things aren't according to how we think they should be. When we freak out, we are not making ourselves any happier. We make demands on ourselves and people that are unrealistic because we think it's going to make us happy. It doesn't. You know the story. I don't have to go on and on about that. So meditation gives us an opportunity to go beyond that a little bit. And Pema, and the book we've been using is called Living Beautifully. And I'm not thrilled about the titles. It's actually a rather somber book in many ways. But she talks about like living in the middle. And Buddhism is called the middle path. And she cites Hopi elders, H-O-P-I elders, who talk about not feeling safe on the river, not staying on the safe river bank, but going into the middle of the river, and how we increasingly need to learn how to depart from the riverbank and get into the river, as turbulent as the river may be. Of course, we know in current events that the river tends to find the banks at some point. But barring that, it's an invitation to embrace life's totality. So, and it's in that context that we talk about waking up. What we usually do is, you know, I remember being confused for a long time about back when I was first getting into this stuff. It's like, what is this thing about waking up? What's asleep? I'm not asleep. Except when I'm supposed to be. So what's the deal? And we could say, not that we're asleep, but we make ourselves numb. Or there's a part of our lives that we live sort of automatically and unreflectively and kind of as if we're asleep, just going through it. And so waking up is bringing back a certain sparkle in our minds, a certain sparkle in our lives, the vividness of our experience, even when it's difficult, especially when it's difficult. It's actually more powerful that way. Waking up is also appreciating the details of life. And this is something the Stoics don't talk about, but the Buddhists do. As you may have figured out, I've read a lot of the Stoics. I love them dearly. I especially read them after the 2016 election. Immerse myself in the Stoics. Somehow meditation wasn't doing it at that time.
You ever send out an emergency release on a regular basis?
Yeah, I could have done that last weekend, couldn't I? I was too bummed out. It doesn't always work. Well, there's a slogan called whichever of the two occurs, be patient. All right, I want the positive to occur so I can be patient with that. That would be fine. I'll work with my mind and happiness much more clearly than working with my mind and misery. But that won't last anyway. So, Trungpa Rinpoche especially talks about appreciating the details of life. And that we don't have to tell Alexa to do everything. We can do things ourselves.
He said that when he was very prescient.
He was very prescient. Who? She said, who's Alexa? She might be interesting.
He actually talked at one lecture. I remember talking about how we would be completely distracted by gadgets.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yes. Well, we had enough gadgets in like the 1980s. Yeah. It was exponentially. So we are learning, we are unlearning the art of dealing with mundane reality. And at some point, we have to re-educate ourselves. So, we all know how that manifests in our lives. So, waking up means living in some ways, living life completely. With the understanding that life is not easy. This is not an affirmations contest here. So, by the way, I listened to the recording of last week, and I wanted to. Michael Levin said something really interesting. He said, "Why isn't there a specialist on envy management?" He said, "There's a specialist on anger management. How about envy management?" And my response is, "Well, there was. It's Shantideva. The Way of the Bodhisattva is the best book on envy management." So, and I'll read a few verses from here. But
what about the dog?
What's that?
What about the dog?
It's not the verse about the dog. I don't think dogs are actually mentioned legitimately here. But so, part of waking up, though, is understanding things. And we sort of know our buttons. We know how certain family units can sort of get certain responses out of us. We know how our boss can get certain responses out of us. We know how we can just do it ourselves. We just have to think about it enough. So, we've talked enough about managing emotions, but what's behind it? What is the mechanism that drives all this misery that we put ourselves through? And Buddhism has a few answers. Buddhism talks about how we solidify this thing we call me, and we're constantly trying to maintain it. We also solidify our states of mind. We think that my state of mind defines who I am as a person. And that, of course, doesn't work. But there's another teaching that Pamela discusses that's a personal favorite of mine. It's called the 8 worldly concerns or dharmas. Now, I want to take that apart a little bit. Starting with the number 8, I'm being very Tibetan. They are 4 sets of 2. 1 is fueled by hope. The other one is fueled by fear. So hope and fear, hope for positive consequences, fear of negative consequences, really kind of keeps our misery going. It keeps our small-mindedness going. Dharmas, or Pema calls them concerns. I like the word dharmas better. And the reason is that technically a dharma is something that comes up and goes away. So there's nothing solid behind this. As you'll see, these are made up of mind in the moment over and over and over again, very powerfully. And we think it's continuous, but it isn't. So these are not permanent psychological states, but they're habits that we have. And worldly kind of gets us trapped in the specifics of our lives and prevents us from seeing beyond that. So we could call it 8 areas of self-concern that immobilizes other movement. Okay, there. I said two. Here's a little Shantideva for you. Chapter on meditation. He's trying to describe worldly people. And in this chapter, he's saying, these are the people that you might want to stay away from because they can just corrupt you. But we are worldly people. He goes, and he talks about them being childish. He said, and think of a kid wants the immediate thing, wants everyone to like him, does not have a philosophical or a meditative state of mind. So he says, one moment friends, the next they're bitter enemies. Even pleasant things arouse their discontent. Worldly people, hard it is to please them or us. A beneficial word and they resent it, while all they do is turn me from the good. And if to what I say I close my ears, their anger burns a cause of low estates. And this is my favorite. Jealous of superiors, they vie with equals. Proud to those below, they strut when praised. Say something untoward, they seethe with rage. What good was ever had from childish folk? Goes on like that. So, it's very bleak. It says, with other people, we envy those who have it better than us. We feel superior and proud, disdainful to those who have it worse than us, and we compete with those who are equal. That covers pretty much everybody.
Yeah, it does.
So let me give you the overall structure. Four groups of two. The first one's easy. Pleasure. We go for pleasure. We want to avoid pain. Okay, that's easy. We go for gain. We don't like loss. We want fame. We dread disgrace. We shine with praise. We're miserable with blame. So, our mind can oscillate very easily between these eight concerns, trying to attain the former four and trying to avoid the latter four. And it kind of defies a lot of what we do. Trungpa Rinpoche once said, our discursive thoughts and meditations, what is it? It's 80% I and 20% am. I forget the exact fraction, but you get it. So, I'm going to launch into these eight, but questions, thoughts, ideas, reflections, distractions, irrelevancies.
Competing with the peers and
yes.
Stuff. Well, it's not just the human dilemma, it's kind of a mammal dilemma. It's
sure.
Any pack animal that's just
blue.
Well, it's not just mammals, I was thinking chickens actually.
Yeah. You were,
all right. Chickens,
yeah.
Just worked on a farm today, so. But no, definitely more mammals. I mean, that's where we are. It doesn't mean we can't rise above it, but we're totally wired for that.
Exactly. Exactly. And I walk a little 15-pound dog. And the dog is really clear on who's on top and who's not on top.
Does it ever change for your dog?
No. I'm the alpha. Okay. He doesn't quite treat me like that. I'm sorry?
We used to have horses, and the only time that it ever changed was either choosing a horse or the mix. Mm-hmm. And then other one would fight again, and they'd resell on maybe a different pecking order. So it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in the same herd, it won't change. But if you introduce a variable, then you
horse. And but humans are herd animals.
But humans change all the time. I mean, apes change all the time. And they're constantly, especially.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. They change while they're remaining the same.
I mean, their orders change.
But the program still stays.
Oh, yeah.
This is not a digression, because the eight worldly dharmas are very much about us as we'll call it psycho slash physical slash social beings. That's why they're called worldly. Not evil or bad, but they we get stuck there. And they mobilize our misery. Okay. Any thoughts? Questions, contributions? You all know this stuff. Pleasure, pain. We all do this constantly. We oscillate. We have degrees. We also know that we can get stuck in a yearning for pleasure. We can get stuck in a feeling of pain. Pleasure, pain is psychophysical. And even when it's emotional pain, it's bodily. Emotional pleasure is also physical. We can sort of feel the changes in ourselves. It's part of how we're built. Pleasure is nature's way of reinforcing pain, even when it's like stupid stuff. And pain is nature's way of warning us, even when it's unnecessary. So it's not that pleasure and pain are problematic for our lives as humans here, but we can make a mess out of it. And this is not to say that we have to become like ascetics. We have to, like, not care about pain. Try to endure suffering. You know, Buddhism is the middle way. Remember the life of the Buddha? He tried that route. It didn't quite work for him. So somebody gave him some yogurt and he felt really good. He said, I'm going to get enlightened tonight. And the rest is history. And this is, yes.
Hope and fear kind yes. of two sides of the coin, like, or at least that's what I can
mm-hmm.
understand. Does Buddhism say that one leads to more suffering than the other? Because I feel like in Western thought, you know, hope is a positive word, and you know, being hopeful is a great thing, whereas
mm-hmm.
fear is a very negative thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at them as, you know, really kind of the same thing.
They can feed off each other. Hope is a loaded word and a positive word in our culture. And it usually, we use the word hope, I think it means something like a forward vision. Hey, run on forward vision. Absolutely. The forward vision part is not problematic. What's problematic is that with it can come some expectations of happily ever after. And in the big things and really in the small things too. Yes.
You and I have both seen Shawshank Redemption, and we've spoken about the interesting
one of my
thing
top
that
set.
Within the
okay.
context of our culture, which does put a very positive light on hope, it was very jarring for me to see the film, and I saw it when I was much, much younger than I am now, to hear that statement. Hope is a very dangerous thing coming from the Morgan Freeman character.
Mm.
It was jarring because we're in this bigger context of hope being positive
yep.
in the midst of a dark place.
And I don't remember that scene, but what I'm thinking of is if you're stuck in jail for a very long time, you need to make a relationship with being in jail. And not spend your time wishing for an alternative. And it becomes a form of entertainment and sort of self-gratification. That's sort of in that context. Here, it has to do with an expectation that gets frustrated.
So, I mean, it's really that we're always, and the hope is we want it to be the happy part.
Yes.
Of whatever.
Permanently
happy, like if I just do the right, it will all be good.
Sorry.
And then fear is, I mean, it's sort of, it's like we're trying to only look at
the bright side of life.
Like that. And then we're not seeing. Like
some
fear.
People probably haven't seen the movie. Okay.
The fear is the, like, not looking. Like, I don't want to look at all the bad things that could happen.
Right.
And so it's a non-acknowledgement of what happened. What?
Right.
What?
Exactly.
It feels like more than half, because when we're there, it feels like we're never going to get out.
But also, when things turn on us, we become miserable and angry.
It's not fair.
Like, why, God, did you put me through this? Why me? Why not you?
Well, it's like if you're trying to get a job, you go to your job interview, and I really hope I got the job. If I get this job, everything's going to be great. And it's like the more you hope,
right,
the more it hurts when if you don't get the job.
And you know, even if you get the job, it's just a job. And well, even if you love it, you still have to go to work. And that's painful. So, pleasure and pain is a very interesting one, because we can track it constantly in our lives. Because we're constantly going through these oscillations of comfort, discomfort, sometimes physical, sometimes emotional. The Trungpa Rinpoche and the Tibetan tradition in general makes fun of us Americans for being so comfort and luxury oriented. And even the Europeans make fun of us. There was a study on the effects of air conditioning on students, and they used Americans. And the guy said, this is what is in Italian, the guy said, but these are Americans. Of course they're going to fall apart without air conditioning. And a friend of mine once was hosting a Tibetan lama of some kind. As a roommate in his apartment in Somerville, and there was a heat wave. And the guy comes home and to his Tibetan friend, and the place is like really hot. And he says, well, why are you putting the air conditioner? He says, what are you doing? He says, I'm fine, it's a little hot, but I'm okay. And it's not that he was being stoic, it's like, oh, it's just a degree of discomfort. It's all right, it's just hot. Why should I get freaked out? And of course, as we make, my friend thought this guy was totally nuts, but it actually makes some sense. And Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about, sometimes it's good to wear clothes that are a little uncomfortable. It wakes you up. You don't have to make that a habit, but we don't have to continually, change the thermostat or continually adjust our lives to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Because it never works. I have this, I do running, and when you do running, or any kind of working out, you have to deal with pain. There's no, you have to be, there's a certain kind of discomfort that everyone goes through when they work out. And it's just part of the landscape. It's not a big deal. You have to pay attention when it's a warning, but mostly it's just discomfort. And it's important for people to sort of push themselves a little bit, not too much, so that they can do a little better. But I had this contemplation of, actually starting when my father was dying, I thought, compared to what I'm feeling now, when I'm dying, this will be nothing. And maybe what I need to do is pay attention to the principles of pleasure and pain, considering that someday I'm going to go through the dying process. Maybe sooner, maybe later, maybe all of a sudden, maybe protracted. But pain is going to be part of things. So, So you know all about that. And how in meditation we can work with that. Work with, we may find that our misery is less, even though misery is less simply because we're okay with just a little more discomfort, which is inevitable because we're in this flesh. Anybody before we go to gain and loss? Personal favorite of mine?
It's going to get worse.
It depends. Depends who wins the playoffs starting next week. As a semi-occasional football fan, I root for two teams, the Patriots and whoever the Dallas Cowboys are playing. And I love sort of playing with these little competition things because it's fun. And we're sort of built that way. We compete with equals, right? However, we get stuck there. Gain and loss. We can talk about material acquisitions. We can talk about the money in the bank or the car we drive or whether our financial person has a furrowed brow or not. Increasingly, American culture divides itself into, quote, winners and losers. Remember the bumper sticker of a few decades ago? Whoever dies with the most toys wins. I mean, that is pure fixation on gain and loss. So, we get stuck there. However, remember those of you who got into Atisha's slogans last year. What's the one about this? It's like, in all situations strained with slogans, an example is gain and victory to others, loss and defeat to myself. That's pretty radical. Remember that slogan?
Yeah,
it's a slogan. Point two.
Does that Whoops. Say you're pushing gain and victory to others, or is it somewhat a persecution complex?
It's not a persecution complex. No, 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 no.
It just says gain and victory to others.
Let others have gain and victory. Let myself have loss and defeat. Is a generosity toward others, but it's also saying, this is not a big deal. Who cares?
Well, that's what makes it easier. But actually, next chapter, the next
yes.
chapter is going to discuss how you can generate that kind of attitude.
Right.
Well, we're here, we're just dealing with the futility of those dharma, the equilibrium right. dharma.
But
you just realize you're endlessly circular, going around and around.
Uh-huh.
You're just trying to get out of it.
And so something like a slogan like that, victory or gain and victory to others, loss and defeat to myself, it's shocking to the system, which tells us how strong it is in our system. And I invite you to check it out. just in case you haven't yet. But check it out. But this is the important thing. Check it out with intelligence.
I have a good suggestion.
What's that?
I've had to work with this. Somebody else gets the parking spot that you wanted.
No.
Right there.
Erica.
The first thing that'll come up.
You're scaring me.
And then you can flash on this slogan. And it's applicable all across the board. And I found it very, very useful in a kind of an ordinary, mundane way of using the
These come out very ordinary, mundane ways. We do this through symbols all the time. You know, who's going to do the dishes after dinner tonight? You or you? I cooked. And I mean, this is truly liberating stuff, because we have been on that nice, pleasant riverbank, getting consumed along with everyone else in profit and loss, and gain and loss, and trying to get something we want, and avoiding not having something. And now we can actually see it for what it is. It's not evil. It's not terrible. It's a worldly thought. It's one of the things that is part of our social, cultural nature, but it's a trap. And we can do better. That's pretty much the attitude that we can take toward this. Go Red Sox. Okay. Yes, we can do. So, this brings us to fame and disgrace. Where are they about that? Pema quotes Shanti Deva talking about fame and reputation sort of as a sandcastle. Just get blown away by wind, water, whatever. And all of us want to be esteemed by others. Is anyone indifferent to that? I don't think anyone here is indifferent to that. We all want to be loved, not by everybody, but by a certain number of people. We do want a lot of people to think higher of us. But then you have to think about that a little bit more. We begin to realize that our longing for reputation is fragile, because it's dependent upon others. And as we know, sentient beings are very oppositional. You want it one way, they do it some other way. We also know that no matter what we do, some people will not like us. So sad.
But that also can drive our behavior. Thinking that if I just play my cards the right way,
yeah,
everybody will like
me. Yeah.
Strategizing.
Yeah. Back in my 20s, I was co-teacher for supervising training course, another place of law firm, and the evaluation came back in this other t-shirt, and there were like 14 people in the class, and 13 were very positive, and one person hated me. I had no idea who that person was, but it was mostly women in the group, couldn't stand me. And it was really amazing, because it was A, so different from the other evaluations, but B, it was so visceral. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, this person almost said, every time this guy walks into the room, I want to puke. It was that level of invective. It's like, and I never figured out who it was. It's okay. It was sort of like weird. But that's the impact we have on people. 13 of us like us, and one of us wants to throw up, and we walk into the room. It's open. and we can't do anything about it, one of us.
How much time did you spend thinking about that wine?
It was a good story. I didn't brood on it, because it was obvious. If the class was less successful, and there were like four people who really hated me every time I walked in the room, I would have taken a little bit of a harder. We also know that quote, fame is fleeting. But we also know that it's there's no happily ever after to it. There are people who are stimulated by greater visibility, greater fame.
Really?
There are. And now we call it branding. Another thing that drives me crazy. And when you look at these people, you realize they're no happier. In fact, many of them are pretty damn miserable. Wanting to get everyone to think well of you and to love you is a real sign of pathology anyway. People talked about that a lot with Bill Clinton. Said he has this compulsion to get everyone to love him. And it didn't work out. We also know that disgrace is hard to take. Especially if it's somehow in some public way, you see yourself diminished by others. We are built to hate that stuff because we're herd animals. And we have to, I think, recognize that there's inherent, like pleasure and pain, there's going to be an oscillation, that we can live in the middle. That we don't have to compulsively seek to have everyone think well of us, nor do we have to freak out when that doesn't work out. We can stay in the middle and not know. We're going to care, but we don't have to care completely. And, you know, part of meditation practice is allows us to detach just a little bit from the flurry of what we do. We're doing that here. And, you know, many of us don't want family, but we're pretty okay if people think well of us.
How's that different from praising money?
But we're going to get into that. They're obviously close. Praise and blame is more everyday. Mm-hmm. We aren't all famous or visible enough to have a real reputation, but we get criticized and we don't like it. We get praised and we get a little puffed up.
So is it really just kind of, again, putting it into practice and just becoming aware that you are being compulsive or, say it in this case, worrying about what people think of you?
I think that's the beginning.
Yeah. Okay.
You start there. It goes far.
Take it a few steps further.
It goes far. But part of the awareness is we see ourselves getting into it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Right. We begin to appreciate the compulsive quality of it. Paradoxically, as we appreciate the compulsive quality of it, it usually lessens.
I would say this whole thing of, you know, how we feel about other people and how other people feel about us, it's very, not just impermanent, but it's very just leaving. Like, you find that the way you feel about somebody changes over time as you become familiar with them.
Sure.
As things happen, or you are drawn to somebody and then you're, you know, they do something you don't like. And
yeah.
It doesn't last.
Exactly.
Either way.
That's kind of the punchline. That what these polarities do is we try to fix ourselves in cultivating one, avoiding the other, as if there's a fixed state that's going to happen as a result. That we're forever free of people not liking us, or we're always going to experience only physical enjoyment. We actually like have these thoughts.
Yeah.
And they're not only like incorrect, but because they're incorrect, we burden ourselves with them. And let's talk a little. Anything else about praise and criticism?
If your whole focus is on having everybody like you, then you can't do much. You can't do anything. You know, because I'm just a
because you're dependent.
Remember from long ago, it says, who makes no enemies makes nothing.
Right. That's right. And even the Buddha had one of the Vedanta, I believe his name is, thought he was a complete fraud. And I love that story of the life of the Buddha, because you think, hey, he's a Buddha, he's enlightened, everyone's going to be just worshiping on his feet. And this guy thinks he's just, you know, some kind of new age hippie kind of guy. And I find that very comforting. If the Buddha can have people who think he's, who don't like him, then who am I to get so pissed off when somebody wants to throw up when they see me? But I think, well, part of it is that kind of seeing ourselves swell or diminish. And it's almost physical. When somebody kind of criticizes you and they kind of nail it and you kind of know it, how do you feel? It's really creepy and it's sort of like you just shrank 5 inches.
I mean, the expression that I was acting small.
Yes. Yeah.
Humbled.
And when somebody praises us, it's like, you know, there's a certain kind of puffed upness we get. And, you know, we have to sort of let the air out of that. And we'll see ourselves dwelling. It can have quite the afterburn, either direction. And it's not that we are invulnerable to this. It's all our vulnerability. So we start with awareness, and then what happens? A couple things. One is a sense of relief. And this is how things are paradoxically the case, especially in this jhana, that the more trapped we feel, there's a relaxation that also comes. It's like we're stopping looking for a solution or something else or for us to get better in a hurry. We can actually see what we're doing, appreciate what we're doing, and work with it. And all of a sudden, it doesn't feel like such a big deal. And that sense of relief, we can call it simplification, is like, and we get this with maturity anyway. We care, I mean, everyone says, after I turned 50, I cared less about what people thought of me. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some kind of truth in that.
Because you just can't think as much.
Can't hold it together.
There are some advantages to a weakening brain. Regardless, when we look at teenagers, we see how trapped they can be by pleasure, pain, fame, disgrace, loss, gain, criticism, praise and blame. And all of us, none of us are teenagers, I see here. All of us have proceeded a bit towards some sense of, we call it maturity, I believe. We can go further. Meditation practice helps us go further. Understanding this sort of stuff helps us go further. We see that it's a mechanism, it's an assortment of habits that we compulsively do, and they are common. And we can lighten up, have a sense of humor, but also begin to appreciate that this characterizes everyone you meet. Your spouse, especially. Not just your parents. You begin to notice more the vulnerability of other people. And you begin to have this sense that, you know, we're sort of all kind of stuck in this soup that just keeps on going round and round and round and round. And we get, I mean, those of us who work with people directly on some of their, like, personal issues, it's like, it's, you know, there's a part of it which, oh, God, they're just like me. I do that too. And it's, I especially like it when, you know, for people seem to have their act together, they have lots of money, they have rich, successful lives and all that, and I find out what it's like to be them. And it's like, oh, they suffer too. They suffer more than I do. They're more miserable than I am. That's why they're paying me. Sorry?
They have more to lose.
Often they have more to lose. That's right.
Or they
can
figure.
Or they can figure. I live by down in Narragansett, and I love bicycling by the rich people's houses on the beach. And, you know, I never envy the people who have them, especially because I think about how much kind of taxes they have to pay and what kind of a lawn service they need, and how much they have to do just to maintain this. What's that?
How hard you're working not to be.
Not very. Not very. I'm okay with limited gain. But we have, you know, all of us have our own predisposition in common with that. So the ground, the ground path and fruition, the ground is, we can call it meditation practice, seeing our minds work. The path is we go out in daily life and we find how easy it is to get hooked by one of these four polarities. And working with that becomes part of our lives, as well as a way to connect with our own mind, our own basic goodness, our basic intelligence, and a way to connect with others. Because they're going through the same things we are. They just look different. So, Emily had asked about supplemental reading for this course. And I thought it would be actually interesting to put on, either you want to get it, or I can put on as PDF some of the relevant verses in Shantideva. Because Pema quotes them like every other page. So, and she has her own commentary, which hopefully we'll be able to study soon, this year or next year. It's called No Time to Lose, another cheerful title of hers. And it's her commentary using this translation.
What is the translation?
It's called Way of the Bodhisattva.
It's available on a PDF, e-book if you want it.
You can also listen to it on your car tape deck if you wish.
Did you read it yourself?
On our website, there's also the our own translation committee's translation of part of the Shantideva, and it's got very beautiful language, which isn't found elsewhere.
I will look at it.
Somewhere around Module 4. So
okay.
Module
4.
I think. I forget exactly.
I will look.
But it's there.
But there's a search engine on your website.
Unfortunately, it's hard to find.
Okay.
You can try it.
I'll do what I can. Great.
Just as the earth provides sustenance, something like that.
All that. Okay. And I especially want to do this because next week we begin Mahayana. So we will be looking at chapters
6, 8, 8.
Second commitment, committing to take care of one another. Number 6, beyond our comfort zone. If you haven't heard enough about this already. Chapter 7, breathing in pain, breathing out relief, otherwise known as Tonglen. And number 8, the catalyst for compassion.
Well, just stay on the first chapter. So, for next week's topic.
Okay. Yeah. Or you can just read through and have a good time.
Yeah.
So, okay. Any thoughts, questions, ideas, disagreements?
About the place and blame and even the reputation.
Yes, yes.
Part of it for me is how much do I buy into this thing that I'm being praised for? Mm. It's so conditioned. And one of the things about coming from one culture to another is you realize nothing like this is set in stone.
Yeah.
Right.
The worst thing for a woman to be from where I was when I was growing up was to be thin. And if she was thin and tall, she might as well throw herself off. Thin.
Poor Taylor Swift, I feel bad for her.
It's changed now because it's become more westernized, but really, I mean, oh my goodness, why should she, you know, like, must have done something really bad.
They didn't feed her.
Yeah,
because, you know, and then it's sort of so if somebody now, when I go back, you say, well, it doesn't bother me because I've moved away, you know, mm-hmm. like I can see how with every culture it's different, it's not as thing that's set in stone that I need to accept. I can just say, well, that's the
thing. See, the bottom line is we all want to be cool. And the fact is that none of us are cool. Or we're all cool. We're all the same temperature. So,
there's a quote, yes. And I don't remember which chapter it is, but I really like it, so I wrote it. We may think those poignant, piercing feelings are signs of danger, but in fact, they're signals that we've just contacted the fundamental fluidity of life.
Yeah. Okay. Look at this for punctuality. 9 o'clock.
Wow, you did a great job being on.
Thank you. I love fishing for compliments.
Does anybody need the closing chance?
We have.